You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And President Biden is sending tanks to Ukraine. We have one heck of a show for you today. Senator Chris Murphy stops by to tell us the unseen reality of what's really happening at the U.S. border. Then we'll talk to The Washington Post's Jeff Stein about what the options are in the debt ceiling negotiation. But first, we have former United States Senator Al Franken. Welcome to Fast Politics, Al Franken.
Thank you. Now, we just talk real fast?
Yeah, we talk really fast. Well, the hope is that people are listening to this on 10,000 speed, and so they can barely understand what we're saying.
Okay, well, we're going to talk really fast, so slow it down, everybody.
That's right. Listen to us on 0.5. I actually listen, when I listen to podcasts, I always listen to them at 1.75 because I feel like I'm getting so much done.
Well, you know, it's funny. I am a kind of a slow talker. I really am. It's just the way I am. And so I did an interview with Walter Mondale on my podcast. Wonderful, wonderful man. But, you know, Walter talked pretty slow, too. And so I'm a slow talker. So I did listen to us at the thing at 1.5 or something, and it was perfect.
Right. Well, there you go. So that's a suggestion. Definitely listen to this on 1.5. So I want to talk to you about the gift that keeps on giving, the Kevin McCarthy Congress.
Or the gift that keeps on scaring the shit out of us.
Well, that is also true. I mean, that is, I think, the knife's edge about all of this. We know it's bad for democracy. It's in the early midterms when there were some Democrats who supported these fringe MAGA candidates. And I always felt like it was really a dangerous game that I didn't think was worth taking the chance.
Oh, you're saying trying to get them nominated in the primaries, yeah.
Candidates like Carrie Lake and Don Baldick. I mean, thank God those guys didn't win. And I think this is the same situation. There is damage being done by this, even if it ultimately undermines Republicans.
The ones that lost, the really extreme candidates that lost, that I guess I didn't like the strategy of let's take ads supporting the worst of them. And maybe it worked once or twice, but that's just, to me, advertising the worst. And I think it influences people badly. I just think I hated that strategy. And I haven't looked at it. Did it work? Did it work anywhere?
It ultimately worked. But again, you can't calculate how much giving Carrie Lake a larger platform could theoretically undermine democracy in the long game. And I mean, you've got Carrie Lake now. I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about MAGA is that they continue to promote the people who've all lost horribly.
Okay, well, I think the ones that lost really are the ones that in especially heartening was, and I have a PAC. I have a PAC called Midwest Values PAC, which I've had since 2005 that support Democrats. And we put a lot of money into these secretaries of state races. Yeah. And wife said this the day after the election. She said, the American people said, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop it. Stop this chaos and stop this denial. And I think the MAGA base is the MAGA base and they're going to vote for those people. But to me, what people are staring at, what they're looking at is the MAGA crazies that McCarthy has put on these committees that are people are going to be looking at and going like, no. No, we don't want this. We want you to figure out how to actually govern.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't seem like policy is at all interesting to any of these people.
No, no. What's interesting to them is getting on TV and raising money doing that and also disrupting. And of course, you mentioned the debt ceiling, or did you? Or maybe we may.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about the debt ceiling because it's so sexy.
Well,
No, I'm just kidding. But it is. It actually is a big fucking problem. Excuse my French.
It's the scariest problem. And I think your listeners know what we're talking about, of course. And this happened when I was there in 2011. They held the gun to our head, and we actually negotiated with them. And I think that was a mistake because once you do that, they say, oh, I see, every time we get to the debt ceiling. And this is money we've already spent, right?
Right. The way that McCarthy talks about it on the news is very disingenuous. There is a time to negotiate it, and it's not now.
This is insane because we came close in 2011, as you may recall, really went to the 11th hour, and we didn't go over the cliff, but we came close enough that our bonds were downgraded by Standard and Poor's, and it cost Americans billions and billions of dollars. These guys, the people who leveraged their votes to be able to hold McCarthy hostage, they're the ones that would go over the cliff. I thought McConnell was very smart when he said, don't look at me. He pointed to the House. They're the ones that are going to have to negotiate. And I think the American people are looking at these guys and going, they're crazy. I think this crisis comes up around June is what I keep hearing.
June, July. They don't totally know.
When it does, I think there'll have been a drumbeat up to it where McCarthy is going to have to reach out to reasonable, and they're must be, a third of their caucus?
Well, this is the thing I wanted to actually bring up to you, and I wanted to read you. This is Aaron Blake from The Washington Post had a piece, and I think this is such an important data point. He said the Freedom Caucus is 20% of the House GOP, but they will be 38% of the oversight, 44% of judiciary, 44% of this select COVID panel, whatever that is, where they try to put Dr. Fauci in jail, and 50% of a panel on quote unquote weaponizing of the government.
And I think the American people are looking at this going like, that's not what we want.
Yeah.
80% of Americans are vaccinated.
Right.
The people dying of COVID, a large percentage of them are Republicans. There's an interesting stat, which is of the 15 states where the highest percentage of people who died were Republicans, 14 voted for Trump.
Right.
Of those states, and the 15th was Georgia. And I kind of think that like 11,780 Republican Georgians died like the month before the election in 2020.
Right. I mean, I have always asked this question to guests on this podcast, and I never get the answer that is definitive because I don't think people really know. But the question is, like, so many people in this country have been affected by COVID, right? You know, we have more than 1 million people in this country died of COVID. Then we have people with long COVID. Then we have people who have relatives who've died of COVID. I mean, it's such a large quantity that in my mind, I mean, if you think of millions of people in this country have been touched by this virus that the Republican Party said was nothing and not to worry about.
I think what they're now going to say is that Fauci caused that they're going to be going a gain of function, right?
Right.
And so, which is a thing.
It's not related to causing the virus, though.
They're going to say it actually did cause it, which is it's a technology to change viruses, to study them, to see how to eradicate them if they morph into more dangerous ones. And then the dangerous one got out of the lab in China. That's going to be their story that they're giving. And I hope they call Fauci. Fauci, I think Americans who aren't MAGA really trust Fauci and trust science, you know.
Right. It does seem to me what we saw in these midterms, and we were just talking about this, was there was certainly in purple states a real rejection of the stupid. I mean, Michigan is a great example. Like those three women won by a lot, but even Wisconsin. Wisconsin is this very tight, very down the middle state.
And gerrymandered up the wazoo.
Right.
There was some Kennedy School study that basically compared democracy in Wisconsin to the Congo, because they're gerrymandered so badly that for Democrats to get even in the state legislature, they have to win by like 10 points. If you look at a statewide race, like the governor, and the governor won by
four points.
Yeah.
By being boring, he said.
Wow, is he boring.
He's a man.
Boy, he accomplished that. Remember, he hosted, Wisconsin hosted the virtual convention. And I remember he gave like a welcoming thing. And I went like, holy mackerel. But he's a great guy. And Ben Wickler, I don't know if you know Ben.
He's been on this podcast. He's amazing.
Ben worked with me on Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them when he was a student at Harvard, and is now the chairman of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And they have a big, big election coming up in April, I guess.
That's right.
For the Supreme Court, because this will decide majority on the Supreme Court in Wisconsin. And they can undo a lot of what was started to be done back in, you know, after 2010. What happened in 2010 in Michigan is an interesting story, because in 2010, we had passed the ACA, right?
Right.
The ACA was amazingly unpopular because a lot of it was about lying about what it was.
You know, death panels.
Down panels, you know, going to pull the plug on grandma, you know.
Right.
And people didn't know what it was. And we lost on the ACA until 2018.
Right.
We lost. And when we won in 2018 big time, because they tried to repeal it. And then when they did that, people saw what it was. And people realized, oh, my God.
Right. This is free healthcare. This isn't bad.
Well, this is guaranteed that, you know, that I'm not going to be rejected because I have a pre-existing condition. And when the Republicans tried to, they didn't guarantee that. And people actually got to see what it was when it was almost taken away. But until then, we just kept losing on it. And we lost big on it in 2010 because it had passed and they were lying about it. People didn't know what it was. They just were buying the lies. And so there were states like Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan that all went very red in those elections.
Right.
And the state legislatures took over. And the fact that now Michigan has a state legislature that is run, that is all blue and has...
And all women.
And the women, you know, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General and the governor are all women. That is a huge, huge transformation. But we still have in Wisconsin and in Ohio states that are just been gerrymandered so badly that it's impossible for the Republicans to lose the state legislature.
I wanted to ask you, because we're talking about state parties, and that I have quite a bee in my bonnet about this. During these midterms, we saw Democrats really overperformed, really killed it, with the exception of two states. Florida, which, by the way, I had been hearing what a shit show it was there, and New York State. I mean, what the fuck, man?
I blame the Jews.
This is funny because we're both Jewish.
That's why it's funny, folks.
Right. That's
you
right.
See? We're kidding.
Comedy plus, yes, continue.
Well, New York, that's a heartbreak because what happened in New York was Democrats wrote a map, and it was like one Democrat who wrote this map that was so extreme. It was gerrymandered for us, right?
Right.
And as they do in the states I'm talking about, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania.
As Republicans do everywhere.
Yeah. And then we were doing it. It was so partisan the way it was drawn that the New York State Supreme Court said, no.
Which is a pretty conservative state court, thanks to Andrew Cuomo. But continue. Yes.
Well, what they did was they probably drew some pretty, you know, close to what you would do is fair.
Right.
And then we lost a number of seats. We could control the House if it weren't for California and New York. But part of New York, I had my judiciary counsel, Josh Riley, ran in New York 19th. And he ran ahead of Hochul by like 6 points and lost by one.
Wow.
Pelosi kind of mentioned this in some sort of a peak that New York governor may have cost us the House.
Yeah.
And because, you know, and Josh was, I hope he runs again because he was my judiciary counsel. They ran ads, and this is when I trace like where we started to lose our democracy. Citizens United is a big part of this. And there's so much money run against him in ads that were about crime.
Right.
And he was my judiciary counsel, and they kept basically saying he wants to defund the police. When I was in judiciary and he was my counsel, we funded the police. We did something called crisis. You know what crisis intervention training is, right? Well, crisis intervention training is basically training cops to recognize when they're in a situation that's fueled by either mental health problems or drugs or something like that, and how to defuse situations, de-escalate. And this money had expired, and I did it in a bipartisan way. I did it with Cornyn. We got lots of funding for crisis intervention training and also for bulletproof vests. This is what I did. And they kept running these ads, which is Judge Riley and his allies want to defund the police. And then, well, he didn't, but his allies, suppose whoever they are. Right. And then they would roll this rolling super over him. Defund the police would be over his face, and they would darken his face, and they would slow down some video of him to make him look sinister. And this is like the least sinister person in the world.
Right. All right.
Heart of gold. He's from the district. Right. He grew up in the district.
Right.
He maybe the purest guy I know. But there was tons and tons of this dark money. Of course, we tried to have at least have disclosure of dark money, and Republicans fought that. This, you know, that's when we, that's part of what sent us down this road, that and Shelby County and all that stuff, of our democracy being under threat. And then, of course, what McConnell did on the Supreme Court.
Right. Thank you so much, Al Franken, for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
Absolutely, Molly. Thank you.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Chris Murphy is the junior senator from Connecticut. Welcome to Fast Politics, Senator Chris Murphy.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're delighted. You know, we've just had two mass shootings in rapid succession. You have been really on the front lines of trying to legislate. Where are we?
I mean, first of all, we're in this place where the country pays attention to the epidemic of gun violence only when there are mass shootings. And I know we belabor this point, but it bears repeating that every single day we're losing 110 plus people to gun violence. Most of those are suicides, homicides, accidental shootings. These mass shootings are awful, but that's not the actual story of what's happening in this country writ large. Where are we? We're in a race. We are passing more anti-gun violence legislation than ever. States are passing laws. We passed the first federal law of substance in 30 years. But we're in a race against a flood of guns into our communities. You know, in 10 years ago, 8,000 guns were sold on an annual basis. Today, that number is 20,000 guns. And so there is just a ubiquity of firearms in our communities today, such that, you know, ordinary disputes and beeps between kids are turning into gunfights. People whose brains are breaking have easy access to weapons. And that's our issue right now. The laws are getting better in most places, but the number of firearms out there is devastatingly high, and that's really driving the higher rates of gun violence, I think, as much as anything else.
So how can you get rid of all the guns, or at least, you know, decrease the number of gun sales? I mean, if that's the issue.
Well, I think there's a, you know, very broad conversation that we should have in this country about the sort of fetish around guns that exists, and whether or not we're comfortable as a nation being, you know, so cavalier about our relationship with weapons, whether we're comfortable continuing to romanticize firearms. But we also know that laws do make a difference, even with all of these weapons in circulation. So Connecticut, you know, has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. Let's take a state like Florida, some of the loosest. Connecticut has a gun violence rate that's 400% lower, maybe 350% lower than Florida. That's stunning. Even with the loose national laws, what we know is that if you're just a little bit more careful about who can get their hands on a gun. If you stop the assault weapons from being sold in your gun stores, you can save a lot of lives. So, you know, to me, it's just an invitation to continue to change the laws. It's not going to take all those guns out of circulation, but a lot of these crimes, especially the mass crimes, are committed by people who bought the guns, you know, within a couple of weeks, a couple of months of the crime. So if you stop selling them to the wrong people, you actually can stop a lot, not all, but a lot of these shootings.
There's a lot of evidence, and especially with a lot of these shootings, that there's a domestic violence component. And I mean, we see this again and again and again with women, you know, I mean, even there was recently a case, you know, where this guy murdered his whole family. I mean, this is something we see a lot. I mean, is there any way to connect any of this gun legislation to preventing domestic violence?
You know, what we know is that if you have a gun in your house, you are 5 to 10 times more likely to be the victim of a domestic violence murder. And we really started to address this problem finally last year. So in the gun safety bill that we passed in the summer of 2022, again, the first, you know, substantial gun safety bill that passed Congress in 30 years, we closed something called the boyfriend loophole. This is a big loophole in the background checks law. It basically allowed for domestic abusers who had committed misdemeanors, not felonies, misdemeanors, to continue to own their guns and buy new guns. The problem is many serious domestic violence crimes that really are felonies are pled down to misdemeanors. So there are just tens of thousands of men out there who have committed vicious acts of domestic violence who can buy guns and who can keep their guns. That is over. So all across the country, those people are being dispossessed of their guns. Now, that's going to take a while for law enforcement to go through that process, but it will, you know, be the most substantial thing we've done to try to depress the rates of gun violence connected to domestic violence.
Do you think there's a chance for an assault weapon ban or something to that effect ever being, you know, passed on a federal level or no?
I don't think there's a chance. I think it's a certainty. I see the anti-gun violence movement as, you know, one of the great social change movements of this country's history, not unlike the civil rights movement or the marriage equality movement. We have really only been in existence for 10 years, right? We really are a creature of Sandy Hook. And in those 10 years, we've, you know, made pretty substantial progress. We are now more powerful than the gun lobby. And so I think we are on a trajectory through which we will ultimately get universal background checks and a ban on assault weapons. It might take another 5 to 10 years to get there, but I just think the American public have made up their mind that the current laws don't work. I think the gun lobby is decreasing rapidly in its impact. I think our movement is growing stronger. And ultimately, I think democracy gets its way when 70, 80% of Americans have made up their mind. So is it in the next 2 years? Probably not. But I just think we're on a path to get things like an assault weapons ban back on the books.
So I want to ask you, this midterm election was sort of, I found it very comforting. And I thought that a lot of voting that happened was people in swing states rejecting Trumpism and the extremism. You are in the Senate. There are some really wacky Trumpy senators who have come in. I mean, they've come from very red states. A lot of the really scary ones did not get elected from the swing states. But there are still, I mean, you still have to work with people that, I mean, whether or not they believe the stuff, they've said some pretty appalling stuff when they were running for office. How do you do that?
Yeah, listen, the Senate is very different than the House right now because you have fewer of these wackos in the Senate than in the House. But the problem is the Republican Party isn't really sending deal makers, compromise makers to the Senate any longer. And so if you look at the last couple classes of new Republican senators, they are filled largely with people that were endorsed by Donald Trump, people that are on the most extreme wing of the party. Now, you still have a sort of legacy Republican senators that want to do deals, and some Republican senators who kind of hadn't been interested in deals in the past are more interested in them now because they don't want that crazy wing to take over. So we still have the, you know, opportunity to legislate in the Senate. And the good news is that, you know, somebody like John Cornyn or Tom Tillis, who, you know, maybe 10 years ago or 5 years ago, you know, weren't part of a lot of these bipartisan groups working on compromises to big issues like guns and immigration, are now more interested in doing that because they really are, you know, worried that the, you know, more recalcitrant, more extreme wing of the party is taking over. So there's been an interesting reaction from some Republicans to this phenomenon of Trump endorsed candidates taking over.
It's an amazing thing because, you know, they can't win, right? I mean, they're very unpopular. It's just that you have this primary system where you get these zealots who then can't win in a general, which, by the way, I'm not complaining, but I mean, the people, you know, you do have this intractable situation.
Yeah. And listen, none of it's good for our country. You know, we've got to find a way such that people who want government to work are rewarded. I mean, it's this interesting phenomenon in which in our party, you know, our primary voters, you know, are still interested in pragmatists, right? I mean, Joe Biden ran as a pragmatist. There were candidates way to the left, candidates much more ideologically strident than him. And our party decided that, hey, we want to send somebody to Washington that's going to work with the Republicans. Republican primary voters seem to do the opposite, right? I mean, they have no interest in electing or nominating candidates that are going to work with Democrats. And it's a byproduct of the Republican Party, you know, becoming devoid of ideas. You know, over the last 20 years in my sort of political lifetime, I've seen the Republican Party go from a party of bad ideas to a party of no ideas other than the destruction of government, right? That's sort of the only idea that's left in the Republican Party is just kill government, just strip it down to its bare bones. And the result of that is that the only candidates that can win their primaries are the candidates that are literally running for office in order to destroy government from within.
Yes, agreed. So I want to talk to you about you went to the southern border. I feel like every time I say the word southern border, I don't even want to say the word southern border because I feel like it's we're going into a Fox News talking point. Right? I mean, fuck them. But I do want to say that in my mind, we have this very tight labor market. Everyone wants people to come and work. We have this immigration crisis because of Republicans' inability to legislate and to make a deal. But what did you see there when you went there? Talk to me about it.
So, Molly, I mean, I think there's just quickly like two sides to this, right? There's that side you identified, which is the economic and moral imperative for America to continue its generous immigration policy. The economic imperative, tight labor market, economic greatness historically in this country, dependent on bringing smart people, industrious people to here from everywhere. And then there's the moral imperative, which is that the genius of this nation is our sort of multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multiracial legacy. And let's continue that because that's a great part of America. But the flip side of it is that in a multi-ethnic nation, in a nation that's a melting pot, right, that it is all, it is sort of just made for conflict, made for tension. And so one of the ways to sort of keep our cohesion is to, you know, be clear about what the pathways are to become part of our nation, to become part of the club. And when it becomes really confusing as to what those pathways are, and they just don't look just and fair any longer, it kind of tears apart at a country that is already a little difficult to stitch together. And so I do think it makes sense to sort of acknowledge that the current system is not working and fix it. And I think that's good for American cohesion. I think it's also good for the economy. And so what did I see? You know, A, just way more people coming across the border than we've seen in a long time in a different way. You know, folks not trying to sneak across as much as they are now just crossing the border, waiting for Border Patrol to come and find them and applying for asylum, knowing that that asylum process is going to take 4 to 5, 6 years. So even if they don't qualify, they get 4 or 5, 6 years of working in the United States and sending money back home. That doesn't feel fair to many Americans. But then also a crazy new diversity of geography, meaning in Yuma, Arizona, Mexicans are the sixth most frequent crossers. There are more Russians showing up at the Arizona border than Mexicans right now.
I had no idea, number one. And also, don't Republicans love Russians?
Well, we're not exactly, you know, sure who all these Russians are, but yes, they do. But there's Uzbekis, there's Indians. It just shows you sort of how unstable the world is that people are willing to come here through that pathway from all over. But it also means the job of the Border Patrol and the immigration services is a lot harder right now. And so you've just got to find a way to sort of manage these more diverse and bigger flows in a better way. That probably means processing these asylum cases a lot faster, which means more resources, which is something Republicans don't tend to be interested in. But that's, you know, one of the clear takeaways.
They want to spend money on the southern border, but they don't really want to spend money on processing and having staffing there, right? They want to spend it on like a wall with lots of spikes.
Yeah. And like the wall with spikes doesn't work. I mean,
right.
It's just, you know, I mean, we went down to the border and, you know, we saw all the places where you go around and over and under and through. And the fact of the matter is, so long as we have an asylum process, everybody who being persecuted or has a fear for their life from the country that they're coming from has a right to apply for asylum in the United States, no matter if there's a wall or not. And so unless Republicans are proposing to end our asylum law, which some are, but most aren't, then you're still going to have these huge numbers presenting themselves at the border because they have the right to show up to a port of entry, the gap in the wall, and say, I want to apply for asylum. So the wall just doesn't matter any longer because it's not necessarily people sneaking into the country. It's people showing up and turning themselves over to Border Patrol and applying for asylum. So you've just got to figure out how to reform the asylum process. That's the biggest problem.
And there's no appetite on the Republican side to do that whatsoever.
Well, maybe there is. There's some in the Senate. Let me say there may not be appetite in the House, but there may be appetite in the Senate because, you know, what you're talking about is, you know, trying to move these asylum cases through the system faster. And so for Republicans, they like that because it is true that some of the people who are waiting for the asylum claim for 4 or 5 years end up staying in the country beyond their legal ability. But for us, it also is better to just have these claims, you know, litigated faster so that people know, you know, earlier whether they are approved and, you know, then they can actually stay in the country, legally work instead of retreat into the shadows.
It's such an impossible situation. I really appreciate you coming on. I have one last question. You're running for re-election?
I am running for re-election. I'm not doing like a big splashy announcement or anything. I love this job. And, you know, luckily, I think I'm getting better at it as time goes on.
This will be your third term, right?
It'll be my third term. And, you know, I feel really lucky to have the job. And I'll feel really lucky if people give me a shot to do it for another 6 years.
Your crew is kind of Brian Schatz, right?
I mean, my crew is bigger than Brian Schatz. I mean, he's not enough to lead a fulfilling life in the Senate. So
I feel like him and Cory Booker are your squad.
Yeah, Booker and Heinrich and Gillibrand, those are kind of the crew that, you know, we came in around the same time together and have spent a lot of time over the years. Yeah, over the last year, though, I have spent, you know, probably more time with John Cornyn, Tom Tillis and Kyrsten Sinema between the gun bill and the trips to the border than I have with Brian and Corey and Martin. But yes, that's sort of my original, you know, friend set. You know, when I need to move a couch, you know, that I can't carry alone, I'm calling Brian or Corey.
Thank you so much for joining us, Chris Murphy.
Thanks, Molly.
I know you, our dear listeners, are very busy, and you don't have time to sort through the hundreds of pieces of punditry each week. This is why every week I put together a newsletter of my five favorite articles on politics. If you enjoy the podcast, you will love having this in your inbox every Friday. So sign up at fastpoliticspod.com and click the tab to join our mailing list. That's fastpoliticspod.com. Jeff Stein is the White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Jeff Stein.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks so much, Molly.
Let's talk about the giant coin.
Everybody loves to talk about the giant coin. It's on everyone's mind. It's a great story.
Because it's an amazing story. Give us the backstory. It's debt ceiling giant coin, but give us the backstory, please.
The story of the coin goes back to 2011, when the Obama administration first had this sort of major crisis with House Republicans over raising the debt limit. It was a very different political context than we're in now. But essentially, the Republicans, having swept Congress in 2010, were demanding major concessions from the Obama administration's cuts to Social Security and Medicare that the Obama administration did entertain. And so it gave rise to this question of, you know, the U.S. has a limit on what it can borrow. And so people were all over the place brainstorming, how does the Obama administration, how could they theoretically get around this question of needing Congress to approve an increase in what the U.S. government is statutorily allowed to borrow without, you know, giving in to Republicans' demands that a lot of, you know, economists and Democrats hate and think are really bad for millions of people. And so Carlos Mucha is the verified originator of this idea. He's an attorney, I believe, in New York City. And he came up with this idea that essentially the U.S. government, Congress approved in the 2000s, a law that allows the U.S. Treasury to basically mint novelty coins and recoup a profit from the novelty coins.
I think we should take a step back from our involvement with novelty coins to talk a little bit about the debt ceiling. So we officially hit it this week or last. We officially hit it last Thursday, but because of extraordinary measures, Janet Yellen can keep this whole fiasco, aka the United States government, going until June, when we will have an economic showdown to end all economic showdowns, which will involve jacketless Jim Jordan jumping up and down, obviously. Explain to our listeners why the debt ceiling is a made-up thing.
So Congress has passed two laws that seem completely contradictory. On the one hand, they've said to the administration, to the executive branch, you have to spend on these things, right? Whatever, you know, all the things that the government spends, the trillions, $4 trillion a year that we spend money on. And then simultaneously, Congress has said you can only borrow up to a certain amount. In this case, it's about $31 trillion. And so the math of the first part of this, right, what Congress has told the administration it can borrow and spend and what it's required to borrow and spend, is in excess of what it is also telling the administration that it is actually allowed to borrow against its borrowing limit. So this is the core of the conflict, where we had this impasse where it's impossible for the administration to simultaneously maintain all of the spending and revenue that, you know, and tax collection that Congress has told it to do, and also at the same time not borrow in excess of what Congress has told it that it can borrow in excess of. And so what the administration is doing now, as you mentioned, Janet Yellen has started extraordinary measures, which essentially allow them to do some sort of just basically playing around with money, moving funds around to prevent us from going above that borrowing limit. There are sort of technical things that including, you know, not reinvesting a retirement fund for federal employees. Once the crisis passed, that will be made whole. But the upshot is that we're kind of moving money around to maintain all of the funding obligations without going above the borrowing limit. So we've already hit the maximum amount we can borrow. And so, you know, if we get any closer, once we exhaust these extraordinary measures that allow us to move money around, then we're going to be at a real crisis point where the government is going to be saying, we have millions of payment requests coming in, but we cannot borrow any more money because Congress has told us we can't legally.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing thing. I want you to explain to our listeners why the Republican way of explaining the debt ceiling is so disingenuous.
You know, what the Republicans would say is, you know, they are using the threat of the debt limit to, you know, reining in what they see as this catastrophic problem in America and, you know, in the American government, which is that we have, you know, a $31 trillion debt. What the problem with that is that, as you're alluding to, all of this spending has already been approved by Congress, right, including an $8 trillion run-up of the debt under President Trump, which was the largest under any president in American history. One thing that I think really gets missed from this discussion that is really important to emphasize is that Republicans are playing games with this debt limit. They're risking the possibility that we default on our obligations for the first time in U.S. history and cause a market collapse and what Janet Yellen said would, quote, undoubtedly be a recession.
Right. And it did in 2011. There's historical precedence for this. I mean, it didn't cause a recession, but it caused the market to crash and billions of dollars to be lost.
Yeah, we know that there are real risks here at a minimum. And I just think a really important thing to communicate is Republicans are saying over and over, look, we need a way to force a conversation. They say, you know, the Republicans say, we agree that the debt limit needs to be raised, but we just want to use this opportunity that it creates to have a force a discussion about reining in spending. And what I think a lot of people would say is that, you know, what I think what gets missed a lot is that there is an opportunity to do that. It's called the government appropriations bills. And we have had shutdowns of the federal government that are, you know, your listeners will be familiar with, when the Park Services closes and there's issues with TSA, and it's a real problem and it's a real thing, but it's not the existential threat to the American economy that this threat represents. And so for Republicans to say we need to use the debt limit to do this, I would ask them, and we were trying to understand, why don't you just use the annual process of deciding funding for the federal government for that exact purposes? You can force the conversation. You're not risking a global recession as part of it.
I mean, I also think that it's really disingenuous because Republicans agreed to these non-funded tax cuts under Trump. And they, in fact, agreed to the raising the debt ceiling twice under Trump.
Yeah, I mean, there is no doubt that Republicans have had a hand in running up the debt. And there's no doubt that Democrats have had a major hand in that, too. I mean, I think the interesting question here is, like, to what extent are Republicans right that our debt is out of control? And I think you find, you know, even on the left, kind of mixed responses to that. You know, the borrowing has come down, you know, since the height of COVID. But that, you know, the administration is trying to claim credit. Look, the federal deficit came down from $3 trillion to $1 trillion under Biden. I kind of look askance at that a little bit. I mean, we had a generational COVID crisis where every country in the world ran up unprecedented deficits that have since come down. And for the Biden administration to tout deficit savings as a result of that is, I think, a little suspect. I also think, you know, a lot of economists would tell you that the rhetoric that this can solely be solved from tax increases on the rich may not quite be true. In Scandinavia, where they have much, much higher revenue as a percent of GDP and a much more robust welfare system and a much more, people would say, adequate protections for the elderly and the sick and people without health care.
Right. It's not a dystopia.
They also have broader based taxes, which is obviously not dystopia, but it's not just higher taxes on the rich. It's higher taxes on the upper middle class and the middle class as well. And we as a country have been reticent to go there, but that's probably, if we're going to actually maintain higher spending levels, where we need to start thinking about going if we want to look more like Scandinavia.
Yeah, good luck. In my mind, I theoretically agree, but I think it's going to be hard to convince anyone in either party to get excited about that. But one of the things that I think is really interesting here is that during Clinton, we were not adding to the debt. There was a period in American history where we weren't adding to the debt, and that was Clinton.
That's true. I mean, I think Republicans would say, I don't mean to take the Republican side on this, but what they would say is that the deficit reduction measures that were achieved under Clinton were the result of Gingrich's 1994 sweep of Congress, after which Clinton was sort of in a position where he had to, they would say, at least make these deals with Republicans that cut spending substantially, while in exchange for raising taxes in the 96 and 98 budget deals. But it is true. I mean, you're right. Like the last president to balance the books was a Democrat, and Bush ran up enormous debts in pursuit of not just the Iraq war and the war in Afghanistan, but massive new spending measures through Medicare Part D and enormous tax cuts under Bush as well. Although, again, most of those were extended by the Obama administration, right, which also ran up significant deficits.
Right.
When we talk to the Biden people, I think they would say that they see an opportunity to reclaim that sort of Clintonian model of responsible governance. And they are very eager to be like, we want to bring down the deficit. There are people on the left who say, this is not important. This is not a fight worth having. That is not the view, at least the stated view of the Biden White House. They agree that the debt is a problem, that they want it to be reduced and brought under control. The problem is, I think, that they'll face is that much, you know, completely unlike the 90s, there's just zero belief that Republicans will be willing to go along with anything that would involve, you know, any sort of higher taxes. Not that Gingrich was a big tax hiker, but that, and you know, frankly, that you know, the party's mood has shifted on spending. I mean, I think a lot of people look at what Clinton did to balance the books in the 90s, in particular, cutting welfare, and say this was an enormous disaster that has really increased poverty, child poverty. You know, poor Black mothers have suffered tremendously as a result of some of the deals that Clinton cut. And this Biden White House, I think, for a lot of good reasons, is saying we're not really willing to pay that price for the mantle of fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, also fiscal. I mean, I'm kind of the school that a lot of this is bullshit anyway, and that, you know, we should, I mean, I just think it's better to help people, but that's my own personal belief. I just am curious. I think the thing that makes me feel like we are heading towards imminent disaster with this debt ceiling crisis, which is everywhere, is that it just seems like Kevin McCarthy he can barely get things he unequivocally wants done. How is he going to be able to get something like this passed when he's already made deals saying he won't?
God, Molly, welcome to my world. I'm telling you, this is the question that is consuming all of Washington, D.C., and you've articulated perfectly the impossibility of seeing how this gets resolved in a way that isn't catastrophic. People like ask me like, hey, so like what happens with this? And I'm like, I have no idea. Like it seems very difficult for me too. Like the White House cannot give in to major spending cuts after not only like winning the presidency, but you know, like doing really well last year, expanding the Senate. They're not going to turn around and say, oh yeah, thanks for reelecting us and expanding our Senate margin. Now we're going to agree to cut Social Security and Medicare. It's just not going to happen. And frankly, they shouldn't. I mean, to your point, like once you accept that the White House isn't going to give in to anything that McCarthy can take back as a victory, the question becomes, do you think Kevin McCarthy is the kind of person that will put the U.S. economy and the fate of millions of jobs over his own personal political ambition that he spent decades working for? It's like, you know, the Michael Scott meme where he's like kind of like sucking his face in. Like,
it just seems like, I mean, I shouldn't laugh because people will suffer because of this, but it seems inevitable that we are just spiraling towards disaster. I mean, and I think even if Kevin McCarthy were a sort of very moral and upstanding person who cared only about the public good, I do not think he is that. But if he were that, he's still too incompetent to be able to get. I mean, what we saw with his speakership bid was that he actually does not have the votes. So, I mean, I just think that either way, this ends in disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's going to go to Nancy Pelosi for advice on how to manage a caucus.
It just seems like we're in a death spiral.
What I would say is that there's been a lot of talk recently about what kind of non-substantive concessions the White House might be able to offer McCarthy to say, let's start a commission. It might not have any power, but then, you know, you can say that there's a reining in spending commission that we got out of the debt limit fight. And I am very skeptical. We've already talked to the House Freedom Caucus and other conservatives who say, you know, we're not stupid. We can see through that potential outcome, you know, but we'll interpret that.
I mean, they're sort of stupid, but they're not stupid in that way.
Yeah, I think they would be able to, you know, not have the wool pulled over. I think they'll understand if McCarthy reaches a deal that's purely pro forma. And so then that leads us back to like, what are the unilateral options for the White House if they can't negotiate and McCarthy can't give them anything that he can sell to his own caucus? And what I've been convinced of talking to people, you know, at the White House in the last week or so is that the unilateral options are really bad. And I know this gets a little technical. But the issue here is that any of the unilateral options, be it invoking the 14th Amendment to just declare the debt limit law unconstitutional, or minting the giant coin, either one could lead to a really severe outcome, which is that Treasury auctions, right? The process by which the government issues bonds to raise money for its obligations, and then investors come and then bid on that, on those bonds, right? Like that's how the US government funds its obligations, or balances its books, essentially, by raising money. The cost of that could be much more expensive if all of a sudden investors are saying, holy cow, the risk premium of this is enormous because there's a chance the Supreme Court will invalidate these bonds because the Republicans on the Supreme Court
are very partisan,
could say that they're bad. And so that could lead the cost of borrowing to jump by hundreds of billions of dollars that the government will be spending, hundreds of billions of dollars more on each of these auctions. And that's a very scary outcome, because then all of a sudden, huge portions of the federal government will be going solely to paying off these really high premiums on the debt.
I appreciate you so much. It sounds like there's no possible good outcome. We'll definitely have to have you back to talk about all of this as it continues on towards the cliff in June.
I'll be back anytime, Ollie. Thanks so much.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Molly Jong Fast.
Whoever you are. No, Jesse Cannon.
Jesus.
I'm just kidding. Jesse Cannon.
You know the best part about the Trump administration? The incompetence.
It's like the thing that saved us. So yes, the incompetence is the best thing in the Trump administration. It's probably the only good thing.
I'm going to check the box on the right for that one.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Today we learned that AG Bill Barr pressed Durham, you'll remember Durham as the guy with the enormous mustache, to find flaws in the Russia investigation. And then this is a line from, this is a New York Times scoop. Mr. Barr sought to recast the scrutiny of the 2016 Trump campaign's myriad of murky links to Russia as unjustified and itself a crime. So Bill Barr was working behind the scenes to do what Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity were doing in front of the scenes. And for that, that is our moment of fuckery.
Well deserved.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Got menopause? We've got you. Hi, Jackie here, founder of ExoJackie. Feel supported throughout your menopause journey and beyond with our organic protein powders and symptom relief boosts. Formulated to keep bones and muscles strong, ExoJackie products help reduce bloating, hot flashes, and weight gain. Enjoy 20% off with promo code EXOPODCAST. Shop now at EXOJACQUI.com. Made for women by women.